Welcome to Chiropractic Science, where you get to hear interviews with leading chiropractic researchers from around the world. My name is Dr. Dean Smith, and I am the host of Chiropractic Science. I am a clinical professor in the Department of Kinesiology and Health at Miami University in Ohio, and I'm also a chiropractor in Eaton, Ohio. My research interests relate to understanding how chiropractic affects motor control and human performance. Today, I have the privilege of interviewing Dr. Carolyn Fagundes. But before we get to the interview, I wanted to thank all of you who have subscribed to Chiropractic Science, and I'm especially appreciative to all of you who have contributed five-star reviews on iTunes or Spotify or any other podcasting app. These reviews really do help others find out about chiropractic science. So, if you like the show, please take a second and write a review. It will support chiropractors everywhere. Please consider making a contribution to chiropractic science to keep these podcasts going. You can do so on our website by making a donation. All right, on to the podcast. Well, let's get on to the interview with Dr. Carolyn Fagundes. Dr. Carolyn Fagundes always knew that her professional field would be in healthcare. And when she read about chiropractic, there were no doubts about which profession to choose. She graduated from chiropractic school in 2008, but continued to seek answers, which led her to a graduate degree in kinesiology at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul, Brazil. This is where she also had her first contact with the research of Professor Walter Herzog. In 2017, she was awarded a scholarship for the master's degree in cultural diversity and social inclusion in the area of health and social inclusion, specifically aging. Her research was about the relationship between static posture and falls in the elderly. In her PhD, also carried out with a scholarship, she continued to study this relationship, and in 2021, she was awarded a scholarship to study abroad. Dr. Fagundes embarked on a trip to Calgary, Canada, in September to study the strain caused in the vertebral artery during cervical movements and cervical spine manipulation with Professor Herzog. She returned to Brazil in February 2022 and then finished her PhD and currently works as a chiropractor and acupuncturist in her own office in the south of Brazil. Well, Dr. Fagundes, thanks so much for coming on the Chiropractic Science Podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Dean Smith. I was surprised and very happy with the invitation. I would like to mention that you have done an excellent job on this podcast, so congratulations for you. It is a pleasure for me to be here today.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate that. Well, let's get on to some introduction by you. If you could tell us, for example, how you became interested in becoming a chiropractor.
Oh, yeah, sure. So chiropractic is a very new profession here in Brazil. It started around the year 2000. So the first time that I read about chiropractor was in 2002. And I was like, wow, this is what I was looking for. A job in the health field where I can help people in rehabilitation in a non-invasive way and without medication. For me, you know, sounds just perfect. So I started to study chiro in 2003.
Got it. So now you've also been in private practice for a while, and then you pursued a master's and a PhD. So can you tell us how you got on that journey from being in practice to then going on to grad school?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. So on July 18th, 2008, my chiropractic graduation day, I had two certainties in my life. I will have my own office and I will study at least a master's degree. So my graduation was on a Friday, and on Monday I was working as a chiro. And I put all my energy on this, always thinking about my own office and a master's degree. In 2016, I started to work in a clinic who the owner in that time was a PhD student in cultural diversity and social inclusion. And he is a psychologist and invited me to know the research group. And I must confess that in the beginning, I was afraid, I was nervous, for so many reasons. First, because I had been away from the academic field for a few years now. And second, I didn't know if I would be welcome. After all, I was a chiropractor among psychologists. But I quickly identified myself with the group's proposal and with the supervisor, which is amazing and very smart. I started as a volunteer, and in the end of the year, after the interview and some tests, I was selected to study a master's degree in cultural diversity and social inclusion in the area of health and social inclusion aging. After that, in 2019, I started my PhD, and everything was very calm and peaceful. And then my supervisor showed me that we could do more. And I was like, okay, keep going, I'm listening. And then she was like, oh, would you like to study abroad for 6 months? And I was, yeah, sure. And can I choose where to go? And then she answered me, yes. And I was like, okay, I want to study with Walter Herzog. And then I sent an email to Walter in March 2020. And then I wrote him that I was a chiropractor who had been working in the clinical area since 2008, that I knew his work and followed his research. And I even had the opportunity to attend his lectures and meet him in person at the 60th Brazilian Chiropractic Congress in 2017 here in Brazil. So the mail from Walter Herzog already came with the acceptance letter. And then I arrived in Calgary, Canada on September 2021 and returned to Brazil on February 2022. And finished my PhD on 2023.
Well, that's a cool journey. What was your experience like in Calgary? Just curious.
So, I went to Calgary, like I told you, in September 2021. So it was a COVID time. The lab was closed. So unfortunately, I couldn't see the lab working. But I had a lot of meetings with Walter and his team, and I was very impressed with the research. I really like one about the transplant of cartilage in joints. It was a very curious one.
Wow. That's cool. I guess in some way that's got to be a little frustrating when you got there and COVID kind of monkeyed with the, the research capacity.
Yeah, it was. But I learned a lot. It was a great
time. Yeah, no doubt. So how long were you in practice then before you started with the master's?
10 years.
Wow.
I know.
So anytime that happens, then I'm real curious. I mean, what was it about practicing that long that you got the itch to go back to school?
I think it was the moment and the opportunity because, you know, I always think about the masters, but the clinic was my goal, let's say this way. And after 10 years, I was ready to get my own office and to get a master's. I think that was the question of time.
Got it. Do you have any idea how many chiropractors have PhDs in Brazil?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure. But I know probably 5. Maybe a little more than that.
Okay. Yeah. Just curious. You know, I see some people, I think I've had a few of them maybe on my podcast already. And, Dr. Felipe is going to be coming on, in a month or so. So
perfect.
Yeah. So be excited to have him on as well, but,
he's in Australia now.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. So, and you both went to Canada, interestingly enough.
Yeah, that's right. You went to Canada to the University of Guelph, near to Toronto, right?
That's right. Yep. Exactly right.
And he started his PhD there. And after that, he was doing his post PhD at the CMCC in Toronto.
Exactly,
and,
yeah.
Yes. And when I was in Calgary, I went to Toronto to meet him.
Oh, so, that's cool. That's cool.
Yes, it was a very good time because, you know, she showed me the CMCC and he also showed me the rehabilitation hospital in Toronto.
Okay. Awesome.
It was a great time. And we talked a little about his research.
Yeah, there's an amazing amount of resources there in Toronto for sure. Kind of a major hub for research activity, and having the school there is huge. So I'm curious your daily experience these days. I mean, okay, you've finished your PhD, you're back in practice. So is your daily activity, is it completely practice? Or are you doing any research or teaching these days? What are things like now?
So nowadays I am working at my clinic as a chiropractor and acupuncturist. And since 2022, I have been teaching at National Institute of Applied Naturopathy here in Brazil. I teach auriculotherapy. And 2 months ago, I started to work as a supervisor in 3 PhD theses. All of them is about phytotherapeutic. One is about osteoporosis, another one menopause, and another one inflammation. And I also doing, also writing, let's say this way, an article with Walter and Felipe. I hope it's going to be published soon.
Oh, that's great. Well, we look forward to reading all about that. Why don't we go ahead and get started with some of these studies that you've been a part of. And the first one, since you just mentioned Dr. Herzog, Walter Herzog, let's talk about that study that you were able to do with him. The title is Strain of the Vertebral Artery During Passive Neck Movements and Spinal Manipulation of the Cervical Spine, an Observational Study. This was published in the Journal of Bodywork and Movement Therapies in 2024. So if you could walk us through this paper, and I, as you're going through it, if you could let us know, because Dr. Herzog obviously has been involved in a number of these kinds of studies looking at the vertebral artery. If you could let us know how this study in particular differs from the previous studies looking at vertebral artery strains.
Yeah, perfect. So this is the first study about the strain during the phase of the CSMT, cervical spinal manipulation therapy, right? So for example, all these studies done before this one calculated the strain caused on the VA, vertebral artery, from the neutral position until the post-manipulative position, or it means the thrust phase. So until this article, we had no idea of how much strain was on the VA, vertebral artery, during the different phases of the CSMT. So this article is about it. We calculated the strain during the neutral position, the strain on the VA, right? During the neutral position until pre-manipulative position and post-manipulative position. That is the thrust phase.
Okay. Yeah. And so tell us, if you could just dive into it and tell us, like, how did you, for example, how did you measure the strain for those who may not be, you know, familiar with this type of work, and what did you find exactly in the study?
Yeah, sure. So, for this study, for all the studies done by Walter and his team, they used cadavers, right? So, imagine the cadaver laid out, face up. And then an anatomist, suture crystals along the vertebral artery on both sides, right and left. So imagine that you have your head, the cadaver's head on the neutral position, And then you have the crystal suture on the left side and the right side of the vertebral artery. And between the levels, for example, between C0 and C1, between C1 and C2, between C2 and C3, and go ahead. And when you move your head, or for example, on the right side, you are on the right side, and then you're going to do a rotation for the right side, you're going to see that the crystals are going closer. And then on the left side, the crystals will be not closer. So then you go back to the neutral position, and then you can calculate how was the strain caused on the VA during this movement from the left side and from the right side. Sounds clear for you?
Yeah, no, that sounds good. So just to maybe summarize, so you've got crystals on the vertebral artery. As you're moving, let's say to the right side, you can observe what the strain is in the vertebral artery simply by the positioning of these crystals. Is that perfect. Pretty close? Yeah.
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
Yeah. Go ahead. So yeah, let us know what did you end up finding with, you're looking at pre-manipulative, testing, essentially you're going from neutral to the pre-manipulation phase and then, calculating what's happening during those movements as well as the final manipulation phase. And so that sounds really interesting. And I guess I assumed with some of the previous work that maybe some of that had been done, but this is good to get into the details. So yeah, let us know what did you find out?
Yeah, because when I arrived in Calgary, Walter asked me, so we know what happened in the beginning of the adjustment and in the end of the adjustment, but we don't know what happens in the middle of that. So this is the reason why we wrote this article, because we want to know what happened during the process, right?
So, okay, exactly.
You asked me about the results, right?
Yes.
Yes. So it was very interesting, I think, results, because all these studies made done by Walter and his team found that the strain on the vertebral artery were smaller and during the movements of the cervical spine, and my articles agree with that too. We found that all the strain caused on the vertebral artery were smaller during the cervical movements compared to the CS. Empty. So we can think that the possibility of the CSMP cause some dissection on the VA is very small. Very, very, very.
So I want to make sure I understood that correct. So when you were testing from neutral position to pre-manipulation and then the manipulative position and holding it there, presumably, what you ended up finding that the strains were lower than, for example, just doing a range of motion test.
Exactly.
Got it. And how much lower were they?
So we have here, I can show you. Here, so it was 5.3 for C0, C1, 7.2 for C1, C2, and 3.7 C2, C3. Greater than the corresponding strain during the chiropractic spinal manipulation.
Okay, so those strains that you just mentioned, the 6.9, 4.3, and 3.7, those were for the range of motion testing, and the levels of the strains for manipulation were significantly lower, like 1.3, 0.1, and 1.0. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. So it's a lot lower than just going through range of motion, which is You know, that's fascinating because, yeah, I think the argument has been if a vertebral artery is, let's say, strained and could possibly incur some sort of damage because of manipulation, that presumably would be the causal mechanism. I'm making the assumption of that, but if that's the case, then that doesn't appear to be the mechanism.
Perfect. You are totally correct.
So, yeah. So that's really interesting. Now, I'm curious also about the pre-manipulation positioning. I know some chiropractors do that a little bit different. I know, or at least I think I read in the paper that there were a few chiropractors who were participating in this study. So just curious, like for myself, sometimes I find myself, I might wiggle a little bit at the pre-manipulation position before I go ahead and give a thrust. Was for the chiropractors that were doing the study, was there any pause at all between going from neutral to pre-manipulation and then manipulation, or was it all sort of a continuous movement? How would you describe that?
So, no, there were no pauses. Because you should think in two softwares, right? So let's start talking about software number one. So for a better understanding, you can think in an electrocardiogram. So think an electrocardiogram is a test that assesses the electrical activity of the heart muscle. And when you saw this exam on the paper, you're going to see some lines, right? Similar to a graphic. So some lines are higher and another ones not so much. So each line represents a specific moment of the cardiac contraction, right? So, okay, now, you can think in the CSMT. First, the head is in the neutral position, then the adjustment, in this case, MRV, and then what made? And they came back to the neutral position again. So what you're going to see on the software is something very similar to a electrocardiogram when the highest line on the graph should be the adjusted moment. But then you're going to ask me, so Carol, are you sure about that? And I'm going to say to you that yes, I am sure because you know, now I'm going to tell you about the software number two. And for us to know the exactly position of the head on each phase of the CSMT and movement, three spherical markers representing the X, Y, and Z planes were placed on the cadaver at the same time that the CSMT and the movements were done. And then eight infrared cameras were recording it. So after the data collection, what are you going to see on the software is three spherical markers representing the CSMT and the movement. And then after that, you should synchronize the software. And then you would know if the highest point on the graph would be, for example, the first moment. Then you can be sure about it.
Got it. So
make sense for you?
Yeah. Yeah, so interestingly then, you're able to compare not only movements of the head, but also the vertebral artery, just to see what any differences might have been there.
Perfect.
Yeah, so, well, after going through that and reflecting on it over this past year, what do you think are the most important implications from this study?
I think that, you know, the most important implication is that until now, because Walter and his team has been doing this kind of research for 20 years now, and more than 20, actually. And after all these years, all of this research, they showed that the strain caused on the vertebral artery during movements of the CSMT are higher than greater than CSMT. So it's it's not that mechanism that can cause, until now, dissection of the VA.
Got it. Makes me wonder what is the causal mechanism? Let me rephrase. We don't know that that CSMT is a cause. In fact, the papers would suggest that there's it's not a cause, of course. But there's an association, it seems, in some studies. And so let's rephrasing that, we'll say if there is an association, it doesn't look like it's coming from strain, then I wonder what could possibly be unless the association has nothing to do with the strain on the artery or the adjustment itself. I don't know. I wonder.
I don't know either.
it's more room for investigation then, I guess.
Yes, of course. Of course.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have any hypotheses?
Well, I guess it makes me think of the studies by Dr. Cassidy and, looking at, for example, the medical profession where the people seeing a chiropractor were essentially at no greater risk than those seeing a medical doctor. And so it makes me wonder, if there is an association there. Is it because they're already having, let's say, a vertebral artery in dissection when they come into the chiropractor in the first place?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes.
So I guess that's probably the best explanation that I've heard for a potential association. In terms of cause, it doesn't seem like there has been any cause elucidated, just an association at this point. And I wonder if it's, a spurious correlation. I'm not sure.
Yes, exactly. You're totally right.
Well, what kind of studies do you think might need to be done next? Have you thought about, or has Dr. Herzog mentioned any upcoming studies or studies of interest that you want to do after this one?
So that's a very, very, very good question. A few days ago, I was in a biomechanical conference here in Brazil, and Walter was there too. And there were some studies about arteries made through a computer system. And I was very curious about it, and I think that, maybe it's an option to study the strain on the vertebral artery in living humans.
So it's a model of the artery based upon a computer program. That's really interesting. I wonder if you can for example cause an injury to it on the computer and then somehow model how a potential injury would work. I'm assuming that's kind of how it goes, but I don't know.
I don't know, but I think that the goal of this kind of study wasn't the injury or the lesion, but it was calculated a strain of the vertebral artery. And then we could compare to the studies made in cadavers.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so then you could see if there is a difference or not, or whatever.
Yeah, for sure.
Because, I think it's very difficult because, of course, cadavers is not living humans. So it's a way to restudy this kind of mechanism in living humans. I don't know. I'm thinking about it. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I guess I don't know the literature very well on, for example, what the stiffness or strain of a vertebral artery would be in a cadaver compared to a living human. That's an obvious difference. I don't know what that would be. Do you have any idea what the differences might be in terms of strain?
So I was talking with Walter about it at the conference, and then he told me that he thinks that is not a good idea, because on the computer we will not have the he used the expression, so I'm gonna use it too. The muscle on the artery.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yes, and I agree with him. So
that's a good point. Yeah, I wonder if not to dive too deep, but I wonder if some of these software programs try to account for, you know, the muscle within the artery itself, and the impact of the autonomic nervous system on controlling that. Yeah. Well,
probably the software, you know, is thinking just about the artery, right? Because this kind of software, let's use it, how can I say it? Is it used to study the artery, not the artery with muscles and, you know, all there's stuff around it.
Yeah, with everything intact. That's right.
Yeah.
And working and reacting to,
exactly,
you know, these sorts of things.
Yeah, exactly. You got it.
Well, the next topic we're going to dive into is one that I'm really curious about also, and this is risk of fall, cognition, and static posture in aging. And this paper was published, part of your PhD work, Open Access Journal of Gerontology and Geriatric Medicine 2022. So I'm curious if you could walk us through this paper, and just to maybe give the basics of the paper away here. It sounded like you were assessing the relationship between potential falls in elderly cognitive performance and static posture. And I'm very curious about the static posture part, because a lot of my research has been looking at postural control and, for example, movements on force plates and dynamic movement. But this is looking at a static way to try to make the relationship to falls. So yeah, if you could just give us some details on this particular study.
Yes, for sure. So for this study, it was used 107 subjects, and then aged between 60 and 89 years, and divided into groups. The first one formed by 54 individuals who practiced water aerobics, and the second composed by 53 elderly people who participated in a computer program. And then for data collection, it was used the mini mental state examination and fall efficacy scale and varied balance scale and postural assessment software. And then in the end of the article, the conclusion was that the greater is the perception of self-efficacy and vertical alignment of the head, the lower is the risk of fall. And the greater, the bigger, biggest, whatever, the angle of the thoracic symphysis and the angle of the input, the greater is the risk of fall.
Huh. So the more, if I understood that correct, the greater they stood or perceived them standing upright, the less the risk of falls, mm-hmm. and the greater the thoracic kyphosis and mm-hmm. ankle angles, the greater the risk of falls.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Wow. So, okay. So now curious, how did the software program calculate the thoracic kyphosis and the ankle angle?
The postural assessment software, it is a software that was developed by the University of São Paulo here in Brazil. And then it is a software that works this way. So you want to have your patient, you know, stand up. And then even I use markers, for example, on the shoulder. And then the software will give you where to put all the markers, right? So you're going to put on the shoulder, left shoulder, right shoulder, and right rib, and left rib, hip. And then after you put all the markers, you're going to take a picture. And then you can choose which view do you want. So I choose to do in all the views. So I took a picture of the patient on the anterior view, posterior view, lateral view, lateral right, right and left lateral view. And then after that, you're going to put this photo on the software, SAPO, right? And then SAPO will do the, will give you the angles. Because, you know, once that you put a line between right shoulder and left shoulder, and then there is another line, a horizontal line, and then the software will give you the angle.
Okay. Go ahead.
For thoracic, what I did is to put the person on the lateral view. I put one marker on C7 and another one on D12, and then I calculated the angle there.
Gotcha. Okay. And that is with respect to, let's say, a plumb line or just a
exactly.
vertical.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I'm with you. So that, that angle, how much was it related to the risk of falls?
So, above 56 degrees is considered, increase of the thoracic stenosis. So above this is considered the risk of falls.
Okay. 56, did you say?
Yes. 5'6".
5'6". Okay.
Yeah. Above it.
Got it. Just curious, in your subjects, do you recall how many out of the 107 were over that 56?
I don't remember, but I have here, I think it's, I don't know.
it's okay. I just curious how many actually were above that. That's pretty fascinating.
I think, I'm not sure I can give you the answer later, but I think that none of them was above 56.
Okay. 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 And the other question I had, it just came to me now. You were talking about these two groups. One was you got them from they were doing water aerobics, and the second one was they were participating in doing computer programs. Did you analyze a difference between those two groups at all, or those were just the subjects that you had access to?
Yes, I had access to, and then I compared them.
Okay. So which out of those two groups then, was there a greater risk of falls in one group versus the other?
Mm-mm. Was the same, basically.
Same.
Yeah, it was a surprise for me because, you know.
You were probably thinking the water aerobics would have less risk of fall. Yeah. Okay. So that didn't seem to make a difference. That's pretty interesting as well. And what about the cognitive part? That was assessed, assuming with that mini mental state exam.
Mm-hmm.
The cognitive part. So what did you find any differences between the two groups on the cognitive part?
No difference.
No difference there either. Mm-hmm. Okay. Huh. So it was really the just the angles that seem to be the greatest relationship to falls.
Right.
Huh. So what do you think, I'm just curious then, what do you think could be at play there? Why would these increasing angles at the ankle and the thoracic kyphosis be related to this perceived risk of falls and the cognitive issue?
So The problem is, imagine that you have a person and you are looking at her on the lateral view, okay? And then when you have the forward head position, and then you have increase of the symphysis, and then you have the alteration, let's say this way, on the angle of the ankle, all these three alterations together make like the gravity center is dislocated to forward, and then it's easier to people to fall.
Got it. So it just, so basically it's a shift of their center of mass.
Yes, exactly. Perfect.
Okay. And that makes a lot of sense. And I would expect to see some changes also, for example, on a posture, we'll say a force plate kind of measure, center pressure mm-hmm. changes. I imagine they might be a little bit forward as well. And it'd be really interesting to look at their dynamic movements like walking or that sort of thing, how they shift from mm-hmm. one position to another. But that's really interesting and makes me think of wanting now to relate or correlate the static posture to a more dynamic posture and see what would come. I think there are some groups that are trying to look at that. I know at Miami, we're interested in looking into that as well as a possibility. So that, yeah, it's just very curious and interesting study that you have there. So thank you for doing that. It gives me a lot to think about how to relate some of these things and always, you know, some of the most, I say, challenging parts of research are figuring out, you know, what the variables are that you should be investigating. So those particular angles might be of use for us in the future for sure. So thank you.
Well, my pleasure. Welcome. And, you know, when I started to do my master's degree, I was thinking something like, I'd like to do something that the chiropractors could use on their daily practice, right?
Right.
So I think that the results of these studies show this. I think that it's something kind of easy to see, you know. So if you have an elderly person that comes to your office, you can analyze that. You can look at his posture, or with her, or whatever, on the lateral view. And if he has, whatever, these alterations, forward head, increase of symphysis and alteration of the ankle angle, you could be, how can I say, alert, because it can be a sign of the fall, and then you could think about how to help him.
Exactly. Yeah. So that would be a very quick screen
exactly.
exam, I'm assuming.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Perfect. Yeah. Taking pictures, and there's all sorts of software out there that can calculate these things from an iPad or your phone or something like that. So that's great.
Yeah, and then you could use the MIDI mental state examination is something that it's a cognitive screening. So it's very easy to apply, and you're going to take it to 5 to 10 minutes to do it. So maybe it's something that you can use on your office too if you want.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I could almost see something like that being used as, you know, just a health screening out, I don't know, at some sort of, I don't know, maybe a mall, or I don't know if people do that anymore, screenings at malls, but I'm assuming they do. And so, yeah, anywhere people gather, I guess, you know, it could be a quick screen to just suggest. I'd love to see more research that's will be done to follow up on this finding, because if it is a consistent finding, that's, like you say, it'll be just an easy thing to incorporate into practice.
Yes, that's right. Perfect.
Well, let's get on to the to the next paper here, and this is analysis of the relationship between risk of falls and static posture in the elderly. And you're going to help me with this in the valdocinus RS region. I'm not sure if I said that right, but and this this paper, I tried to translate it using Google Translate, but I'm going to have to rely on your description of what this study is and how it relates and perhaps differs from the study that we just talked about.
So the study that we talk about, we had more instruments. So we had the fall efficacy scale, that it's a scale that assesses the fear of falling. And then the mini mental, and then, yes. And this one is just with a postural assessment software and the Berg balance scale, right? The Berg balance scale, it's a scale that is validated instrument for the functional evaluation of the balance with 14 tasks with 5 items each. And then, so in this article, I just analyzed the relationship of falls and static posture. And then shows that 100% of the subjects had forward head position and low risk of falls. And then it also a direct relationship. So the higher, bigger is the angle of the thoracic scaphoides and the angle of the ankle, the higher is the risk of falls. And an indirect relationship. So the lower is the alignment of the head. So the bigger, the higher is the risk of falls. So this is the study about it.
Okay, so the postural assessment was compared relative to the Berg balance scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, gotcha. And so that's where the numbers and the correlations are coming in. I found it fascinating that you describe that 27.2% of the variation in risk of falling was explained by these posture variations. That's a pretty significant number, actually.
Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah, in terms of the coefficient of variation, we'd call mm-hmm. that. So that, I mean, that means that 70 some odd percent was not explained by mm-hmm. it, but nonetheless, in terms of prediction and coefficient of variation, that's a pretty substantial number. So, yeah. So I guess in this study here, looking at that level of, we'll say predictability, is the same sort of analysis apply here in terms of the Berg balance scale relationship to this posture in that, mm-hmm. you know, forward head forward. Mm-hmm. And that's crazy that every single person had forward head posture.
Yes. Yes. And you know what I think that is curious on this study? It is because 100% of the subject had forward head position and low risk of falls.
Yeah.
You know, like I told you before, if you look at the person on the lateral view, you should think that forward head position is gonna is something related to the higher risk of falls. So I think that this study shows that the just one study alteration is not enough. So it seems that once that you have forward head position plus increase of the thoracic scaphoides plus alterations of the ankle, of the angle of the ankle. So these all three alterations suggested the risk of falls.
Okay. So the 22% or 27% variation, that was a coupling, was it, of thoracic kyphosis, ankle mm-hmm. angle, and forward head posture. Okay. Okay, gotcha. So yeah, that's fascinating. Again, another fairly easy thing to measure in the office with a variety of different software products, or of course, if you know somebody has X-rays, they could calculate that as well. But you wouldn't have to. You just need some way to calculate the angle. Primitively, I guess, even you could calculate that. So, fascinating. Now, in the article, you talk about direct versus indirect relationship. Mm-hmm. Could you just describe that for us? I wasn't sure what that meant exactly.
Yeah, sure. It's not a problem. So the study shows that there is, at least on these people, a direct relationship between the thoracic symphysis and the angle of the ankle. So the bigger, the higher is the angle of the thoracic symphysis and the angle of the ankle, the bigger or higher is the risk of falls. So this is a direct relationship. And then indirect relationship is when you have the lower alignment of the head. So it means the lower alignment of the head means that the head is more disaligned. So the bigger, the higher is the risk of fall. So this is an indirect relationship.
Okay, gotcha. So coming out of this study, then, what would be some things that you thought to go forward in this line of investigation? Would you be interested in looking at more angles, or do you think the angles that you have with the forward head, the thoracic kyphosis, and the ankle angles, do you think those are sort of the key ones? Or I don't know if you looked at other ones and you scrapped them, you know, you just got rid of them. It seems like these three are pretty good. I don't know if you thought of any others that might be advantageous to look at as well.
You know, I have all the angles, and then, but these three are related to falls. But yeah, they have all of them. And I was thinking for the future, maybe study some dynamic posture.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking about as well. Mm-hmm. And being able to relate these angles that you've been able to demonstrate related to falls, and then, put them into dynamic. I would assume, I would hypothesize, let's say, that these increase in angles would, because it would seemingly shift the center of mass, presumably, that it would be a destabilizing type of situation and put them at a greater risk of fall. But sometimes you don't know until you actually put them into dynamic situations and see how they move. But that would be, I guess, the advantage of going ahead and doing the study, because you never know. People can accommodate sometimes quite well to these crazy angles increase in angles that you found.
Yeah. Perfect. Makes sense.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's, I always have guests on the podcast try to motivate and assist practitioners, whether they're chiropractors, that's probably who's listening the most, since it's a chiropractic science podcast, but also students in being able to pursue research careers in chiropractic science. I'd love for a lot more chiropractors to follow the kind of path that you've gone through and experience what research is like, and then to be able to contribute to our science. So just curious if you can offer any advice to these aspiring chiropractors or students who wish to become scientists and researchers.
Oh, yes, for sure. So I was thinking about it, and I thought about in four items. So I think that the first item is be open to the opportunities. Because if you are open it's going to happen. And then another thing that I think that changes everything is that I participated in the research group as a volunteer. So as a volunteer, I was able to improve my academic resume. And for the reason, I got these scholarships. So I think that volunteer, it's a very good way to start. And three, I think that you should be brave. Because, you know, something that I always think is something like, you know, I will try a yes, because I know, answer no, I already have. So this is what I thought when I sent an email to Walter. And then I was like, okay, I'll send him. And if he send me back, you know, and send me, oh, Carol, I'm sorry, not available. And I was, okay, at least I tried. But it was a yes, and it changed everything. So be brave. You should try. And then the fourth item that I choose is, I think it's important to learn English.
I think your English is pretty good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
But, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. But yes, it is important to speak, because, you know, the literature in chiropractic is basically in English. So it's important to read, and it's important to publish the articles in English too, because most people can understand it and read and understand it. So I think that it's important to read, to write, and to speak, to listen. So I think that, you know, learn English, it's very, very important and a very good point.
Well, those are excellent points. I really like the, you know, the volunteer and just put yourself out there. I mean, yeah, it may be a little bit uncomfortable. There is a little bit of a risk, but like anything else, starting a practice is tough, right? And maintaining a practice is tough. Reaching out to people is tough. But I don't think it's any different or any tougher than what a lot of chiropractors have already done. Not at all. It's different. It's different for sure. But it's. But I think, you know, people who are in practice, especially, already know this, and so I don't think it would be a huge stretch, but definitely a lot of a time commitment. Now, I am curious, since we're talking about this, when you did the master's and PhD, was it full-time? Like, what did you do with your practice? Were you part-time in the practice? How did you do that?
No, it wasn't a full-time. So I was working at the clinic during the day, Monday to Friday, and then I had classes in the evening, at night actually, on Thursdays and Fridays. And then I was reading and working on my master's and PhD during my free time, weekends or something like that.
Yeah, so you really didn't have any free time.
It was a moment that I was like totally focused on my job and on my work, and
yeah,
totally
yeah.
Worth it.
Yeah, no, I get it. But I'm sure it was a ton of time, but again, we appreciate everything that you do, and thanks for doing what you do, and these studies are important. So keep up the good work, and I hope you said you have another paper with Dr. Herzog coming out.
Yes, exactly. With Walter Herzog and Felipe.
Nice.
Yes. Felipe Duarte.
Right. Is that in peer review yet, or what stage is it at?
No. We are finishing it.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
We don't send it to any magazine, journal.
No journal yet. Okay. Got it. Well, we'll be on the lookout for that. And like I said, I'll be interviewing Felipe soon. So
that's perfect. He's a great guy.
Well, thank you so much, Carolyn, for coming on the podcast. Most appreciate your time and everything that you do for the profession.
Please, no. I appreciate the opportunity, and thank you for listening. And yes, please keep doing your podcast. That it's amazing. It's great for the job, for the chiropractic field. And yes, please keep studying too, because I like your research.
All right. Thanks very much. Have a great day.
You too.